Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Nearly 60 years ago, on Queen Elizabeth's coronation day, May 29th, two members of the 9th British Expedition, New Zealander Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay of Nepal, reached the summit of Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. They were the first. Many more have followed. Coming up, we'll hear from a seasoned climber who participated in the historical 1999 expedition during which Mallory's body was found. Mallory was preceded Hillary and Norgay. We'll also talk with another seasoned climber whose father was part of the first American team to reach the summit, who has since turned his sights on cleaning up Mount Everest. Joining us now is John O'Meara. You know John, he served as executive director of the Metro Parks since 1998. In a completely different role, John is a member of the High Pointers Club and has climbed to the highest natural point in every state in the United States. He has also scaled the highest peak in South America. And later on this month, he'll make his first journey up Mount Everest. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be here.
For our listeners, have you ever dreamed of climbing Mount Everest, the highest peak in the world? Is it a dream of yours? Give us a call and tell us why. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, of course, if you have any questions for John or any of the guests coming up, you can make that call as well. You can go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post there, or you can tweet at Ann Fisher WOSU. So, John O'Meara, how long has it been a dream of yours to be a mountain climber in the first place?
You know, I didn't really start out dreaming to be a mountain climber. I've always been an outdoors enthusiast and outdoors adventurer, and so that's always been kind of where I started, and it kind of evolved from enjoying spending a lot of our times, lots of camping, going to backpacking. Eventually, backpacking trips took me up mountains. I learned to love the beauty of the mountains, the tremendous scenery, the wildflower displays. So it just kind of grew on me through the years.
Mountain climbing is one thing, but sometimes I wonder, is it more like rock climbing when we hear about people doing just scaling those faces that way? Is it a lot of that?
You know, on Everest, and most of my climbs have not had a lot of that. The harder climbs all have some rock face involved, but typically not extensive. It's not like climbing El Capitan in Yosemite or some of the things you might have seen recently and some of the other TV shows where some people are kind of pushing the limits there.
When did you get started on tackling the highest peak in every state?
Well, that was really something my wife brought up, I think it was back in 2003. So she read about the High Pointers Club and said, you should do that. You've climbed several of these peaks already. And so she kind of convinced me I should set as a goal. And I always do kind of look for goals. It keeps me working hard, working out, staying in shape. So it was good to have a new goal that gave me a reason to go back and visit new peaks.
And so what's the lowest, highest point in the United States?
Was that Delaware? I think it was Delaware that was the lowest. It's in a residential neighborhood. It's you know, the marker's right in the a street. You know, it does have a benchmark there, but it's in a neighborhood and in a subdivision.
If you're just joining the show, my guest is John O'Meara. We're talking about his planned trip to Mount Everest later on in March. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Coming up later in the conversation, we'll be talking about efforts to protect the environment of Mount Everest since it's become such a popular destination for mountain climbers. It may be a dream, but it does take years of training and to attempt such a feat. And I was wondering how long you've been actually contemplating an ascent of Mount Everest and how long you train for something like that.
Well, those are two different questions. My standard answer, how long I've trained, is really it's been 40 years
yeah.
doing related things that are good experience, good training. I got serious about it a couple of years ago. Was talking with some friends who suggested maybe we could put together a group to go there. The group didn't work out, but I guess I got convinced that now was my time if I was ever going to try it.
And do you do anything different except just this usual training? I suppose you – I don't know. How do you train for that?
You know, my primary training – obviously, we don't live in the mountains. We don't have high altitude here. So my primary training, and for most of my trips, is you put on the heavy pack and you find some steep local terrain. You know, I go down to Clear Creek quite often. I go up to High Banks if I just have time in the evening, not as steep there. But Clear Creek has some, you know, good steep hills that go up and down 400 feet or more. You know, it's not going up thousands of feet like you would in the mountains, but you can get the same degree of, you know, this difficulty for short bursts anyhow. So that's been my primary time. I also do gym workouts. I go to, you know, do stair climbing workouts, do a variety of things. But I really do rely on the thing that's closest to what I'll really be doing there, which put on a heavy weight and go up and down.
You've climbed the highest, scaled the highest peak in South America. It's called Aconcagua?
Aconcagua.
Aconcagua. Tell us about that and what that experience is like.
Well, I did that just last year, and I did it just to kind of, I guess, test myself on. It had been almost, it was 1995 when I climbed Denali, which was the only other peak I had climbed that was over 20,000 feet. And so I wanted to go there and see how I did at an altitude. Aconcagua is 22,800 feet. So it's actually the highest mountain outside of the Himalayas. And that was a great experience. There were some other folks from Columbus that were on that trip, which kind of made it fun training together and being there together. It gets up fairly high. It worked out well. I did get nausea one day. I had to fight through for several hours. But other than that, I stayed healthy on that trip, and it worked out.
When you head to Mount Everest later on this month, are you going with people from Columbus? How do you hook up with people to how do you get on an expedition?
In this case, I've just signed up with a guide service. So I did talk. You're going to talk to Andy Politon a little while later in the show, and Andy recommended International Mountain Guides. It's what he thought was the best team on the mountain. So I signed up with the guide service. I don't actually know anybody on our team ahead of time. After 10 weeks with them, I'm going to know them very well.
So it's a 10-week
It's a 10-week total period I'll be gone, yes.
It goes in stages. How does that work?
Well, it's a two-day flight there. Then we spend a couple days in Kathmandu where they check everybody's equipment and go get the permits. And, there's some procedure things you have to go through. And then we do a little, we get on a small plane and fly to a town of Lukla, Nepal. And then we start walking. It's a 10-day walk from there to base camp. So just getting to base camp, you've been gone 2 weeks before you even get to base camp. And base camp is at about 17,600 feet, so that's higher than any peak in the western U.S. in the 48 states. So you're starting out, and that's really where the mountain starts getting steep. Up to that point, it's all been a fairly gentle grade.
You mentioned after 10 weeks, you'll certainly get to know them, but it's more than just time. It's what you work with them. They're part of your experience. They're not just there.
Absolutely. You're going to be roped to some of these people. You're going to be working very closely with them.
You get to know them, and hopefully you like them.
That's right.
Have you done this before where you go up with groups of people you don't really know beforehand?
Yes, I have. When I climbed Denali, it was that way. I did not know anybody in the team before I got there.
And how does that work out? I mean, what if there is a personality conflict?
And that's always a risk, and that's part of the challenges you got to overcome if it occurs. And but you've got a lot of like-minded people. They're there. Sure, not everybody's going to get along, but you sort those things out, and it's worked out fine.
So who are your guides? Are they from Nepal, or are they someone from a group in the West?
The lead guide and the guides, per se, are all Americans in this case. This is a Washington State-based company. Mike Hamill is going to be the head guide of our group. Then they are supported by a team of Sherpas, which are porters, if you will. Sherpa is a tribe of people from Nepal who have lived for centuries up at high elevations. And so we do have quite a few Sherpas on the team as well.
614-292-8513. If you have a question for my guest, John O'Meara, he is executive director of the Metro Parks since 1998, but we're talking to him now about his hobby of mountain climbing. He's going to be heading to Mount Everest, later on this month. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is the most challenging part of this kind of experience for you?
There's some things I don't know. I don't know how the body's going to really respond. I've been up to 22,800, but that's still a mile and a half lower than Mount Everest at over 29,000 feet. So adapting to the altitude is certainly going to be very difficult, and that's what I expect to be the greatest challenge. I mean, it's also going to be very cold, but I've got quite a bit of experience not only with climbing, but also I've gone winter backpacking many times through the year. So I'm fairly comfortable in very cold temperatures, have the equipment for it. So I really think the altitude-related issues are the more likely problems to be encountered.
We have an email from a listener. They write, I'm reading Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. It's about how surviving World War I spurred Mallory and others to scale Mount Everest. I'd be interested in your guest speaking to what drives him and others today to take such risks.
And I think we all acknowledge it's you have to be willing to take risks. There is considerable risk involved here. I always think about it in the sense of what people want to achieve important things. And this is not necessarily an important thing, but you always, you know, if you're a baseball player, you want to be the greatest baseball player. If you're a novel writer, you want to write the great American novel. I think it's the same sort of thing. It's a hobby as opposed to, you know, vocation in this case, but you want to pursue, and I find many benefits to it. I mean, it keeps me in good shape. You have to train, you have to work out, you have to stay healthy. So there's year-round benefits involved in this, and it's tremendously beautiful up there. It's dramatic scenery in places. Other places, just outstanding beauty. In this case, I'm also looking forward to the cultural experience. I'm going to be spending 10 weeks in Nepal. Going to be visiting cultural sites, getting to know some of the people a little bit. As mentioned earlier, a 10-day walk through some of the small towns, getting to know other folks along the way. So I'm looking to all those aspects of the trip. Looking forward to them.
There's a long history of, as I mentioned earlier, previous ascents at Everest. What's been learned about the equipment and the preparation and the challenges? What's changed over time the most?
It's certainly not an easy climb. I don't want to make this sound easy, but it is easier now for us than it was for earlier folks, the folks that were successful 50, 60 years ago. We have better equipment. We have warmer equipment. We have learned other techniques that are more effective. In this case, because it scales so often, there's also a lot of the pieces of equipment are in place when we get there, so we don't have to carry up as much equipment and secure, you know, ropes and ladders in place. That will be there when we get there. So it's easier now than it was for earlier folks, but the equipment is also much better. I watched the film on Mallory, and his mountain climbing boots looked a lot like golf shoes.
They look like cross country ski boots to me or something. They're just like nothing to them.
Exactly. How did they keep their feet warm in those conditions? Now we have boots that, you know, the ones I'm wearing, they guarantee my feet won't freeze at 60 below.
Right. Which is, you know, is a comfort, no doubt. Right. You're heading up there. Let's take a call from Jim in Columbus. Hi, Jim, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I was just kind of curious, if you climb a mountain in every state, where did you find a mountain in Florida?
Mountain is not the right word. It's the highest point of every state is really, and a third of the states actually don't have anything that resembles a mountain. There's certainly a third of them that are challenging hikes or more serious climbs, but there's quite a few of them. It's just getting to the highest point, but it's not a mountain. It's not a mountain here in Ohio. It's over by Bellefontaine, but you drive into the parking lot of a joint vocational school and you walk over a little bit to the marker.
Well, in Florida, what is the highest point?
It's in a little county park. It's in the Panhandle near Alabama. I forget the name of the county park, but same sort of thing. You pull in, you park in the parking lot in the county park, and you walk over a short distance to the actual high point.
Do most states designate where their highest point is?
Yes, almost all of them are marked one way or another. And most of the states, do something a little fancier than just a benchmark. There's a sign there. There's something proclaiming that this is the highest point of their state.
Jim, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Take care. We are going to continue our conversation about climbing Mount Everest with John O'Meara. And coming up after this is Andy Pulitz. He is an expert mountaineer and a resident of Upper Arlington. He's going to be calling us, though, from New York today. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents Chefs in the City 2012, featuring celebrity chef Hubert Heller. He's the host of the PBS series Secrets of a Chef, along with an elite group of Central Ohio culinary greats. The event and TV show are coming up in May, with a culinary-themed auction beginning online April 15th. Included will be Chef David Tetzloff of G. Michael's Bistro and Bar, who is showcased on our Facebook page. Be sure to like Chefs in the City on Facebook or visit WOSU.org/chefs.
Support for 89.7 comes from OSU's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information at glenn.osu.edu.
69 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high of 82. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 60. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about climbing Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. Nearly 60 years ago, two members of a British expedition were the first to reach the summit. Many more have followed. Still with us is John O'Meara. He will join an expedition in Nepal later this month to make his first climb of Mount Everest. Joining us from New York by phone this morning is Andy Politz. He is a resident of Upper Arlington, an expert mountain climber. He's been climbing more than 25 years, many of those spent as a mountain guide at Mount Rainier. He has traveled around the world on mountain expeditions, including Alaska, Ecuador, New Zealand, Nepal, Pakistan, and Tibet. He first reached the summit of Mount Everest in 1991, and he was a member of the Mallory and Irvine Research Expedition and was present when Mallory's body was found in May 1999. In total, Andy Politz has been on seven Everest expeditions. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hi, Ann. Thanks. Hi, John.
Good morning, Andy.
So I understand that you were actually afraid of heights somewhere when you were like a toddler or something. How did you overcome your fear?
I don't know if that's really true. I know that I couldn't do Boy Scouts because I couldn't figure out how to tie a square knot.
Oh, okay.
About that. Afraid of heights, who knows? If that comes and goes. I'm afraid of heights right now if I don't have time to get used to it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You zip up in one of these outside elevators on some building somewhere, and it takes you back a step. You just need some time to get used to big changes.
To what extent does that have to do with having a sense of control about the situation and your environment?
Oh, boy, that's an interesting question. I think I need to be very crystal clear on what I have control over and what I don't. And when that slips, there's a Tao Te Ching passage, learn to recognize beginnings. And when it begins to turn different from what I'm comfortable with or different from what I'm in right now, then I should be stepping back and assessing what's going on in the situation of, like, a big mountain climb. I don't have a lot of control, but I have some control, and I have to be clear of what I can and can't control.
You live in Central Ohio. We don't have any mountains around here. How have you been able to maintain a career as a mountain climber and a guide?
I travel.
Why do you live here? I mean, why not live near
a
mountain?
Well, I grew up in Columbus.
Okay.
And when I got married, I moved back to Columbus. And really, back when I was guiding on Rainier, I guided most of the time, and then I did construction in the off season. And I've done, various levels of construction type stuff. More of my income is based on, pipeline corrosion right now than guiding, and it's come and gone over the years.
You've been on seven Everest expeditions. Does it ever get routine?
I would think cashing winning lottery tickets would get routine. And so, yes, it does, but it's a magnificently beautiful place.
You take different routes each time?
I like to. I like to see different parts. I've been on all sides of the mountain now, and a couple hard routes, and the two classic sides. One is on Tibet that Mallory and Irvine was on, and then the other side is through the Khumbu Icefall. It's a spectacular place where John's heading to.
British climber George Herbert Mallory took part in the first of three British expeditions to Mount Everest in the early 20s. He disappeared in 1924 on Mount Everest with his climbing partner, Andrew Irvine. Their fate was unknown. You took part in the 1999 expedition to recover their remains. What happened?
It was the first time anybody had ever searched for them. And we kind of anticipated, we'd be standing there with a BBC cameraman waving our arms with the mountain in the background and kind of coming up with something. And never in our wildest dreams did we really think we'd sit there with, well, if I were a climber, I'd come down here. If I do this, you know, each day we'd just go out and search what our instincts would tell us as a climber. If I fell independent of my partner in an avalanche, if I fell in a climbing fall, if we both fell together, if I fell off of a higher climb, a higher difficult stretch and fell down, these different search elements. And actually, within 2 hours of beginning our search, we came across George Mallory. Conrad came across him because he went downhill, and I was directly uphill in a rock gully above him that I'm sure he fell out of.
How did you know it was him?
You know, we didn't. We thought it was his partner. We knew it was anybody past the 24 expeditions, past the – nobody had died on the mountain prior – once nylon had been invented and once crampons, those spiky things you strap to your feet, once those had come along, nobody had died before that on the mountain. And so if a guy standing there in hobnails and woolen clothing, it's got to be one of the old British climbers. We thought it was Andrew Irvine until finally we had started, we'd taken all the pictures we could take before we touched anything. And then we found a name tag on the back of his collar, and then another one, and another one. And then finally found a pouch with some letters and things in it. And you couldn't breathe.
It must have been pretty amazing.
You're standing there with a legend, and you can see why he's a legend. Because he didn't have an ice axe. His rope had broken. And he's falling down, most likely at night, in the dark, down a mountain. And as each layer of security was stripped away from him, he fell back to a more core layer, and he stopped his fall with his fingers and his toe, his other leg being broken and was wrapped around his good leg to splint it, but he continued to stop his own fall, and he did stop his fall. And we had come across other people up on the mountain that had perished. And you could just see the look of terror in their faces. And they had given up. And it was an astounding lesson. Don't give up. But it's also an incredible image of the man.
You said he fell most likely at night. Why at night? Tell me you're not climbing a mountain at night.
Absolutely are. You leave early in the morning. You leave at, I think we, when I went to the summit, we finally turned off the stove at 11 o'clock, at 10 o'clock at night after melting snow and cooking. And then we set on our alarm for 11 o'clock at night. And so by 1 a.m. we're starting up. And our goal is to get up to the summit and back off before the winds start rising. As the day heats up, that air moves up the mountain, and that turns into winds and poor visibility. And so by the time I left the summit, I was in a full-on blizzard. And I had missed a turn on the ridge and started down the route that probably Mallory and Irvine descended, which is a different route than we had come up. And I was very tempted to just descend. This was before the Mallory and Irvine trip, so we didn't have insight from all the historical research. But it was very tempting to go down the route they had probably gone down. But, I figured, slap myself a couple times and let's do this differently. Let's be smart about this.
My guest is Andy Politz. He's an expert.
So you do climb at night.
Okay. He's an expert mountaineer. He would know if you climb at night. And he's from Upper Arlington. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about climbing Mount Everest right now. Still with us is John O'Meara. He is going to be making his first climb of Mount Everest coming up later this month. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So it's common belief now that Mallory and Irvine made it to the summit?
I'm going to say it's a recent book came out, and Wade Davis, in a book called Into the Silence, makes a story for that they didn't make the summit. I would say that I would be amongst the minority in wholeheartedly believing they made the summit. And so I'm completely in the opposite camp from Wade Davis's book, which is a great book. The guy's a great writer. Into the Silence.
When you teach mountain climbing, right?
Yeah, I dabble in it.
Okay.
I just teach the good, the fun parts, not the hard stuff, like, you know, all the important things.
Yeah, right.
I can't. It's a serious thing to take someone under your wing because you're putting them into a dangerous environment. You're teaching them how to do dangerous things, and you somehow have to look in their eyes and understand if they're getting it or not.
Have you ever had somebody that you thought just wasn't cut from the right bolt to...
Absolutely.
Yeah, what do you do in those kind of cases?
You tell them what your assessment is. And I've had clients on Mount Everest, and you just kind of do as much as they're going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And most clients on Mount Everest, John is one of the few. I mean, I look a guy in the eyes, and I can kind of tell just from all the Mount Rainier trips whether they got what it takes. And John has that mix. And, you know, but I'd say, you know, half the people on Mount Everest aren't going to make it. And so, you know, you got to make that trip in good, get lots of pictures, and, you know, because those cocktail party stories got to still be told. And so you got to have lots of good stories, your great adventure. But, John, I'm sure I fully expect to hear great stories from the very tippy top of that mountain.
Well, thank you, Andy. I'll do my best to fulfill that.
Well, I expect to see it. Expect to hear it, John.
You know, I read a book once. It was called Shooting the Bow. By Tracy Johnson, and are you familiar with that?
No.
Well, it's a great book. But anyways, well, she was doing this trip for, I don't know, one of the adventure magazines, one of the outdoor magazines, and she was a journalist, and she was surprised that there were sort of like jet setters, you know, Euro trash and that kind of thing at it, people who, you know, just have a bunch of money and can afford to pay the price and really don't know what they're getting into necessarily.
There are those. And there are those other people that are, it's a deep spiritual experience for them. And you see both.
Jerry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hi.
Hey, I was just curious. I mean, it really sounds fascinating going up on these mountains and stuff. Did you come back with photographs? I mean, are you going to put out a book, you know, so people can see your experience up there?
John, are you planning on putting
John
out
O'Meara?
A book?
I am not planning on putting out a book. I will certainly be taking pictures when I'm up there, and I'm sure we'll share pictures with other climbers, but there's no book in my future.
Gosh,
what about
it sounds
you,
like
Andy?
Work to me. What about you, Andy Politz?
Oh, I've never been disciplined enough to actually finish something. So,
except climb a mountain.
The book thing is a daunting prospect. That'd be fun. I'd love to do it someday.
Well, do you have any recommendations about a good book to read and something good to for those of us who won't make it? Yep. Are you there?
I'm there. I didn't hear John's response.
Oh.
A book to read. You know, Andy mentioned the one that's kind of a bestseller right now, Into the Silence, which I have not read yet. It's one of the books I was looking forward to taking with me. I mean, there are some other classics that give some other perspectives on it. Krakauer's book is perhaps best known. I've read lots of different things. There's lots of different books about climbing Everest, and I guess I don't know if there's one that jumps out in my mind. Anne, do you have any favorites there?
From a climbing standpoint, there's a book a couple British guys put out, Savage Arena. I think Joe Tasker put it out. And it's, I think it may have a story of Everest on it. It's about three or four different climbs, and it captures, like few others, what climbing big mountains is all about. And the guy was a Jesuit priest, and then he got out of it. And he became a big-time mountain climber. And he perished on the northeast ridge of Everest, trying to be the first to climb the complete northeast ridge, and they just never came down. So he's still there.
We have an email from Sarah. She writes, has John read all of the books about Everest and watched all the documentaries about horror stories from mountain climbing? I couldn't imagine climbing knowing all that can and will go wrong.
Yeah, I'm sure I haven't read all the books. In fact, Andy just mentioned one I wasn't familiar with. I've read several books. I have watched three different documentaries. And yes, there are some very serious challenges here. There are lots of things that go wrong. I think we all recognize there's some significant risks here. We try to minimize those risks, but I certainly fully understand that there's danger involved here.
I would like to pipe in on that one. Mm-hmm. Every one of us drives at 50 miles an hour, 2 or 3 feet away from somebody else coming at us at 50 miles an hour every day. We do that. We take that is a far greater risk in my mind than climbing big mountains. Is the traveling, getting there, and leaving there is far, far larger hazard. So,
coming up, Andy, we're going to be talking with Brent Bishop, another expert mountaineer and an environmentalist. And you've gone Mount Everest 7 times now. And I wondered what your thoughts are about the environmental impact of so much mountaineering on Mount Everest now.
I think there's we live in a, I would think you couldn't classify it any other way than an overpopulated world.
Mm-hmm.
And there is not much we do at all that doesn't need to be managed. And the management, there's been an increasing improvement in the management of how we handle our trash, whether it's in the cities, or, at the Schwangunks where we're rock climbing in New York this week. I was there 25 years ago for a summer, and it's cleaner than it was then. It's nicer, better managed. It's you just can't let anything slip away from the management standpoint. So Brent is the one that's the expert on that. Mm-hmm. I don't profess to know anything about the level of cleanliness of Mount Everest from 1 year to the next.
Well, thank you for joining us today and sharing your point of view.
Oh, you bet. It's been my pleasure. John, good luck.
Thanks, Andy.
Take care. All right, see you.
Andy
Bye.
Pulitz, he's an expert mountaineer, resident of Upper Arlington, just calling us from the state of New York where he's rock climbing with his son. Still with us, John O'Meara, executive director of Metro Parks. He is making his first ascent of Mount Everest later on this month. It'll probably be sometime in April, I would imagine, if it's 10 weeks.
Even May, I'll be.
Even May, okay.
May is when it's likely to be reaching the top.
He'll be leaving later this month to make his first ascent. So stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, women are taking over as breadwinners. We'll talk about everything that changes. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins with Tech Tuesday, a discussion of social media fundraising for a cause. Also consumerism and, of course, gadgetry. It's Tech Tuesday during All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 69 degrees with some sunshine in downtown Columbus. Mostly sunny skies for today, warming up to a high of 82. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 60 degrees. Another nice day for Wednesday, sunshine and a high of 83. Partly cloudy for Wednesday night, a low of 60. And more sunshine on Thursday with a high of 80 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about climbing Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. Still with us is John O'Meara, who will join an expedition in Nepal to make his first climb of Mount Everest, probably making it there sometime in May. Joining us now is Brent Bishop. Brent is a longtime and avid climber. He is leading the efforts on behalf of the climbing community to restore Mount Everest after years of environmental abuses by the climbing and trekking community. Brent also is a son of Barry Bishop, who was a member of the first American team to summit Mount Everest in 1963. Brent is scheduled to join another expedition later this month to retrace the steps of that historic expedition and commemorate its 50th anniversary. Welcome to the show, Brent.
Good morning, and thank you.
Your father, Barry Bishop, was the first to publicize the environmental problems on Mount Everest, which he labeled the highest junkyard in the world. Garbage on the mountain included climbing equipment, food, plastics, you name it, paper tents, dead bodies. Why don't people take back what they bring up? That's what I was always taught as a backpacker.
Well, I think they do for the most part, but if you look at, 50 years of climbing on the mountain, it's an amazingly hostile environment to survive. So if you can be more efficient and that means leaving a little trash and surviving, people do that. I mean, if you look back 50 years ago, if people went fishing and were drinking beer or soda pop, they'd sink their beer cans or soda cans and think that they were being environmentally conscious. I mean, climbers are environmentally conscious, but it was just, over the years, trash built up on Everest, and only in certain places. And we started a remediation effort, really, in 1993. And I got to tell you, by 2002, the mountain looks great. So it's a great example of a group of people, climbers in this case, causing a problem and then rolling their sleeves up and fixing the problem.
Some critics have said the situation on Everest still is a major ecological scandal. Do you think it's still a big problem and that the climbing fraternity thinks that their personal conquests are more important?
I don't think so. I think attitudes have really changed on the mountain, and I think people really steward themselves. I mean, there are, I'll say a couple of bad apples out there every once in a while, but you can't get rid of that. Mm-hmm. But in general, people, they pack in what they pack out. There's a tremendous amount of effort to deal with, human fecal matter down low and transporting it down valley. And, the Everest and the Khumbu in general, it looks much better than it did 30 years ago, and it's an amazing example that environmental concern and economic incentive can work together. I mean, basically, the Sherpas and Nepal want the mountain to be clean instead of the climbers, because that means more business. I mean, it's not good business to have a trashed out mountain or a trashed out environment for people to go trekking in.
To what extent does Nepal contribute to the cleanup?
They really don't. The Sherpas do, because that's their backyard.
Right.
But the Nepalese government, all they really are interested in are the peak fees that, that bring all the money into Kathmandu and pay for the motorcades driving around. But let's just be honest. I mean, in 1994, we cleaned up 5,000 pounds of trash, and we still had to bribe our liaison officer to get back our environmental deposit of $4,000. So, I mean, that's what you're dealing with. But, the climbers and the Sherpas, people want a clean mountain, and this is a great example of it looking good. And I think that, I see a lot of expeditions lately touting that they're going to do some environmental work on that, and that's just, I think that that's an entrepreneurial sort of approach to a problem that doesn't exist anymore, just for funding and publicity.
So if it doesn't exist anymore, is that because people's behavior has changed? First, you've done the cleanups, but has behavior changed, and what's changed?
People's behavior has changed. They bring back their trash. There's an environmental deposit that you've got to give the government that you get back if you bring back all the trash that you took. But also, people are just more responsible. And one of the big issues on the mountain was the oxygen bottles that were left. And now they can be recycled. They can be refilled, and they're worth about $50 a pop empty. And if you're looking at a country with a per capita income somewhere between $200 and $300, $50 lying around is a lot of money. So you will not see an oxygen bottle that can be recycled left up there. In fact, all the bottles that were left before, they were useless. And I've got about 50 of them in my garage that I got sent back ages ago. And I wish I had gotten more, because people want them because they're memorabilia from earlier expeditions. And I wasn't thinking when I had the bulk of them recycled in Kathmandu.
To what extent or how are they managing human waste?
Human waste down low is, they're putting in these 50-gallon buckets, and then they're hauled down valley by yaks, and they're then it's used for fertilizer in the fields, which is a great use of it. And there's a really interesting team called Engineers Without Borders, based out of the University of Washington right now, that's working on composters for base camp that will turn the fecal matter into fertilizer right there. So you've got human waste issues. I mean, if you think that every climber or person at base camp has to poop once a day, I mean, that's the reality of it. That adds up when you've got a lot of people in a makeshift village for the season. But people are proactive, and I hate to see it when people say the climbers are terrible for the environment, mm-hmm. and the trekkers are bad for the environment, because they're bringing money into an area, and that money is working to keep the environment healthy.
This is no comparison, but when I was backpacking in Isle Royale, did it a couple times up in Lake Superior, and it was disappointing that there were so many people there. It was like an interstate highway along one of the main trails. You could do anything to get away from it. What's it like on Mount Everest?
It depends where you go on Mount Everest. Like Andy pointed out, I mean, it's a crowded world out there, and Everest is a place people want to be. So, for instance, there'll be a lot of people at Everest Base Camp and trekking in and out of Base Camp, and there'll be a lot of people on the regular route. I'm going to be up on a route called the West Ridge, which gets very little activity, and so we'll be off by ourselves once we get to camp, too. We'll basically take a left from the main route, and we'll be in the middle of nowhere with nobody around us. So, it's you're not going to get away from people on Everest, but the experience is still amazing, and John's going to have an amazing time on that mountain.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. If you have a question or comment for our guest, Brent Bishop, expert mountaineer and environmentalist and founder of Sagarmatha Environmental Expedition. Is that right?
That's right. And Sagarmatha is just one of the Nepalese names for Mount Everest. And we founded that to do a bunch of cleanup work in 94, and then I oversaw that effort until really 2000, and after 2000 there really wasn't any work left to do. So, I mean, people are continuing certain cleanup efforts, but the bulk of the trash off the South Collar at 26,000 feet was brought down, and I've got to spread the credit around. I just helped organize it. It was the other expeditions that provided the manpower, and Nike provided a bunch of the funding, and I certainly can't take credit for cleaning up Mount Everest, but I was just one of the people that helped.
John O'Meara, as you get ready to embark on your own trip at the end of the month, has the environmental issues been brought up to you in your preparation?
Sure, they've been brought up, and I've experienced it. It's been brought up every time I've been on a mountain for years. I'm head of a park agency, so very very much environmentally concerned and aware. So yes, it is very much as Brent said. It's part of the ethic now. We all understand we want to leave it as clean as we found it.
Brent Bishop, you climbed Mount Everest in 2002 with the National Geographic Mount Everest expedition that marked the 50th anniversary of the first ascent of the mountain by Sir Edmund Hillary and the Nepalese Sherpa mountaineer Tenzing Norgay. Sir Edmund Hillary was still alive at that time, right?
Correct.
Did you talk to him or did you hear what he had to say about that anniversary expedition?
Well, you know, I climbed with Peter Hillary, Ed's son, and
I'm
quite good friends with Peter. But one of the highlight of that trip was that Peter made a satellite call to his dad from the summit of Mount Everest. And so, you know, here he is on the summit of Everest 50 years after his dad, and he's able to call his dad. And I was next to him, and Peter was crying, and I'm sure I was crying. And you know, Peter was saying, "Yeah, Dad." And Hillary's step, it was difficult. You know, I great job in 1953 with Tenzing, and that was amazing.
Right.
And it was bittersweet for me because when I climbed Everest the first time in 1994, my father was killed in a car accident a couple of months later. And I understood that connection for Peter up there to literally and figuratively be following in his father's footsteps. And, I like to say as much as I've picked climbing, it's picked me, just genetics, nurture, and nature working together. And I know Peter feels the same way. And there he was up on the top of the world calling his dad, and really a special moment for him and for me, at least just to be standing next to him.
Susan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. I hope this isn't an insensitive question, but I was curious when we're talking about cleaning up Everest, is there an etiquette, if you will, involved in addressing the situation of those who have perished on the mountain?
That's a great question. Is there an etiquette for addressing the people that have died on the mountain? And there is an etiquette. Typically, if you're able to bring a body down, you can. You do. And the Sherpas that help you climb the mountain, you know, they're Tibetan Buddhists, and if there's a body that's been left there, they do not feel it's, for lack of a better word, good mojo for them to move it if it's been left for a certain amount of time. So they don't want to help bring down bodies. But I think in a larger level that, you know, most climbers realize that they're in an environment that if they do get killed, that they'd rather be left up there because it risks their compatriots to try to get them down. I mean, it's difficult enough to survive yourself, let alone, you know, moving someone that weighs 140 to, you know, 200 pounds. So there's an old saying that if someone gets hurt in the mountains, they apologize to their climbing partners. If someone gets killed in the mountains, their friends apologize for them. So, I mean, as harsh as that sounds, you know, it's a suitable resting place for someone that's drawn to the mountains. I think that anyone would echo that.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you very much.
You bet. In the pre-guiding days, climbers on Mount Everest were selected for an exhibition based on merit, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And things changed a lot when the guides came along, providing employment to the Sherpa population for one thing. But when did the guiding days come along? When did that really get to be as popularized as it now is?
Well, the guiding really started. There was a few commercial expeditions and very few in 93 and 94. And then they really started to explode in 96. And then with the death of Rob Hall and Scott Fisher and John Krakauer's book Into Thin Air, you know, it made it even more popular. So really, the mid-90s are when we saw the explosion of guiding, mid to late 90s, and then it just kept on going.
We have an email from Julie. She says, "I'm an armchair adventurer and have read many true adventure books. People's behavior changes at altitude." She wonders how you. She was asking how John O'Meara fared on Anacagua, but just in general, how do you manage when the altitude changes? Yeah, from the changes in altitude, John?
You do get affected by altitude, and it affects us many ways, both the mental and physical body. You know, you notice it. Anybody who's been to Denver knows this. If you get there, and all of a sudden you're breathing a little harder, and you have to adapt. And your body will adapt some given time. It'll acclimatize to altitude, but there are at some points where that doesn't happen. So you're at high altitude, your brain's not working as well, you're not thinking as clearly. Things like your vision are affected. You don't actually see as clearly. Clearly, it's a lot harder just all the things that require oxygen in your body, and that's most things in your body, don't work as well. And you've got to kind of work through to overcome them. So there are lots of things that are affected at altitude, and that's part of the experience.
Brent Bishop, you mentioned the oxygen tanks. When I was reading about, I think it was the Hillary exhibition. No, it might have been the Mallory one, where they found the oxygen tanks, but they were hardly used.
You know, I can't answer accurately on that without, you know, more information.
Well, I was wondering when it became clear that oxygen was a very important aspect of climbing that high.
Well, the history of, you know, people didn't think you were going to be able to survive above 25,000 feet without oxygen. Mm-hmm. So oxygen was always a plan from early on. And then when Reinhold Messner and Peter Hobler climbed Everest in 1979 without oxygen, people didn't know if they were actually going to be able to survive on the top of the world without oxygen. I mean, it was sort of up in the air. Are they going to live or are they going to die up there? And they, you know, they broke all these barriers by being able to climb Everest without oxygen, and they proved to the world that it was, in fact, possible. So, I mean, oxygen was always part of the game from early on, and then a few acclimated and amazing athletes have been able to climb without oxygen. But for the most part, you know, everybody needs it to make the trip work.
When you've done as many climbs as you've done, and General Mary, you can jump in as well. How do you know when it's time to stop, Brent?
Well,
I have no idea how old you are.
I'm 45.
So you're still a spring chicken. But how do you know?
How do you know when to stop? I mean, you've got to have enough reserves in the tank to get back, because, you know, you lose a lot of style points if you don't come back from an expedition. you're assured you're not going to be invited on another one in the future. So you know your body, just like any athlete. You know, if you're going to run a marathon, you don't go too fast in the first, you know, 10 miles. You know that you've got to be able to get to the 26.2 mark, just like Everest or on a big trip. You know what your body is capable of doing, and you always got to keep something in the reserve so if something goes wrong. And that just comes from experience. That's just years of moving in the mountains. And, you know, there are times where you think you can't go on, and you just do, and you realize you've got you've got somewhere deep to dig, and you've got to be able to access it. And I'm sure John's experienced the same thing over the years. So it's just part of the process, part of the learning curve.
Well, Brent Bishop, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I just wanted to say good luck to John. And, John, I'll see you in base camp in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, Brian. I look forward to that.
Yeah, me too.
Brent Bishop and John O'Meara. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ann.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.